Ohiyesa, better known as Charles Alexander Eastman, was born in 1858 into a traditional buffalo hunting way of life on the Western Plains. By 1916, he was a trained physician, educated at Dartmouth and Boston College, who returned home just in time to witness the horrific massacre by the U.S. cavalry at Wounded Knee. He began writing to educate white Americans about the plight of Western Native peoples and argued for the right of Native tribes to the U.S. Congress. A century later, the annuities due to the Dakota Indians for the taking of their resource-rich lands have yet to be fully paid.
I went to Washington, where I urged our rights. While during the summers I still traveled among the Sioux, I learned that scarcely one of our treaties with the United States has been carried out in good faith in all of its provisions. Two large trust funds were established, on which interest at 5% was to be paid annually. In addition, the government agreed to furnish schools, farmers, blacksmith shops, etc., for the civilization of my people, the Sioux. Much of our game had disappeared. The people were starving. It was the claim for these lost annuities that sent me to the capital. Naturally enough, every Northwestern Indian who came to Congress desired to consult me. Complaints of every description came to my ears. I found after many months of effort that political and personal feuds in Congress persistently delayed measures that I had looked upon as common justice. And two of the injured bands of my people have not received their dues to this day. We desire to learn business methods, I said, and we can only do this by handling our own property. You learn by experience how to manage your business. How are we Indians to learn if you take from us the wisdom born of mistakes and leave us to suffer the stings of robbery and deception with no opportunity to guard against its recurrence? There are people who imagine we are still wild savages living on the hunt or on rations. But as a matter of fact, we Sioux are now fully entrenched for all practical purposes in the warfare that is civilized life.
In 1920, during the post-war Red Scare, two Italian anarchists, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, were found guilty of murder and armed robbery. Waldo Cook, editor of the Springfield Republican, was one of many people around the nation and the world who did not believe they were guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. He editorialized against the execution and met with Governor Fuller in Boston. Here is some of his editorial of August 22, 1927.
There is too irrepressible a controversy in this case to justify the irrevocable step that will take place in the Charlestown prison unless the governor and council intervene to prevent the execution. The possibilities of human error loom too large to warrant that final scene in the death chamber. Nor should we of Massachusetts forget that out of the most celebrated miscarriages of justice finally came the truth only as the result of the intervention of individuals who would not be blindly submissive to high authority. This distressing case has become more than a parochial affair, more even than a Massachusetts murder trial. It is international in its implications. When the State Department is forced to send circulars to its diplomatic representatives abroad to keep them informed concerning its development, the American people as a whole are justifiably concerned and disquieted by the situation. Does Massachusetts, in putting two men to death, blush with dismay or anger under the questioning scrutiny of the country or the civilized world? Then surely something is hideously wrong. Whatever it may be, it is not too late to prevent this possible wrong from becoming an everlasting blemish.
Sacco and Vanzetti were executed on August 23, 1927. 50 years later, Governor Michael Dukakis declared that they had not received a fair trial and their names should be cleared. Massachusetts Citizens Against the Death Penalty, founded in 1928, is the oldest active anti-death penalty organization in the United States. The Hampden County Chapter is a member of Western Massachusetts Jobs with Justice.
Francis Perkins is perhaps the most illustrious graduate of the college whose hall we meet in tonight. In 1902, at the age of 20, she graduated from Mount Holyoke College, where she listed herself as not saved. Her economics class year visited textile mills along the Connecticut River, and the working conditions and lack of safeguards for the workers there so appalled her that she championed the rights of industrial workers the rest of her life. Perkins joined Roosevelt's New Deal government in 1933 as the Secretary of Labor, the first woman to hold a cabinet position, and helped secure the passage of the Social Security Act in 1935.
I find that many young people are simply astonished when you say, "Oh, yes, people used to get their arms pulled out in a laundry mangle."
Didn't they get...
No, they didn't get any money.
Didn't they get anything?
No, nothing.
Well, what did they do?
I don't know what they did. Somewhere or other, they buried themselves away in the general population. Girls got scalped in the textile machinery, even in the sewing machines of the dress industry. You'd get down under the machine to pick up a bobbin that had fallen, and the wheel would cut your head off. Men fell into the molten iron pots in the Pittsburgh district and were never seen again. These things were commonly accepted, and it took the efforts of thousands to start the movement towards making a systematic recompense for injury and disability arising out of an accident in the course of employment. Problems of unemployment, education, and health can be solved only when the ideals of a humane mind are translated into concrete terms of action. In theory, the desire of the whole American people is for unity, for brotherhood. The trouble is that too many people are content to emotionalize about it, and that too many intelligent believers are content to talk about it. We of today are standing as Mary Lyon did in 1837. We have our theory of social equality for all, just as she had hers, of equality, of educational opportunity for all. Her greatness lay in that she put into action, in a definite time and place and with certain definite persons, her belief that women everywhere should be educated to the full measure of their possibilities. The challenge to us today is to be doers in the field in which we think. Well.
One of the most powerful voices from the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s and 1930s was the poet Langston Hughes, who wrote of the social conditions of African Americans, the poor, and working people. This poem was written in 1934 at the height of the Depression.
The pot was empty. The cupboard was bare. I said, "Papa, what's the matter here?"
"I'm waiting on Roosevelt.
Roosevelt.
Waiting on Roosevelt, son."
The rent was due and the lights was out. I said, "Tell me, Mama, what's it all about?"
"We're waiting on Roosevelt.
Roosevelt.
Just waiting on Roosevelt, son."
"Sis sister got sick and the doctor wouldn't come because we couldn't pay him the proper sum.
Waiting on Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, Roosevelt.
I'm waiting on Roosevelt.
Then one day, they put us out the house. Ma and Pa was meek as a mouse, still waiting on Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, 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 Roosevelt.
But when they felt those cold winds blow and didn't have no place to go, Pa said,
I'm tired of waiting on
Roosevelt.
I'm tired of waiting on
Roosevelt.
I can't get a job.
And I can't get no grub.
Backbone and navel's doing the belly rub.
Waiting on Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, Roosevelt.
And a lot of other folks, what's hungry and cold, done stop believing what they've been told by Roosevelt. Because the pot's still empty and the cupboard's still bare, and you can't build a bungalow out of thin air.
Mr. Roosevelt, listen!
What's the matter here?
Anna Burns Sullivan started working in a textile mill in Holyoke in 1918. At the age of 14.
My mother didn't like the idea when I had to go to work, me going to a mill, but that was the only thing you could get into, and we needed the money.
She worked in the mills through the 1930s, and in 1936 she organized the Skinner Mill in Holyoke for the Textile Workers Union of America, and went on to become the first manager of the union's Western Massachusetts Joint Board.
The first real organizing I ever did was with my own group down at the Skinner Mill. We got one of the first contracts that was ever signed in textile at the time. Organizing you had to do by personal contact at the plant, so you'd get to go down and hand out leaflets. Well, we had leaflets in Polish and French and English. So every time I went to pass out leaflets, the cops would come right down and run me right out of town. They knew it as soon as I came over the bridge in Ludlow. Well, in East Hampton, I had to go over the mountain. Finally, Roosevelt, the New Deal, and the CIO made the law that we had the right to pass out leaflets. We had the right to organize. Oh, that was the Wagner Act. We'd organize a place within a few days. Well, they had to hold elections in 30 days in those days, not the stalling like you get today. And contracts signed within a short period after that. Well, I got to know a good number of the CIO organizers and some of the friendly professors at Smith and Amherst. They helped when Margaret Sanger came to Holyoke in 1940 and tried to speak on birth control. Well, the Roman Catholic Church was up in arms against Sanger and about birth control. Well, they were absolutely up in arms against her. Well, they wanted large families. No one would let Sanger speak anywhere in Holyoke. Well, that was when I let her use our union hall. Well, birth control was an important issue for our members, but this was also a free speech issue. The church wasn't too happy with me, but a lot of Catholic women came up to me afterwards and told me they were glad we did what we did.
Civil rights activist Yuri Kochiyama was one of the 120,000 Japanese-Americans on the West Coast who were rounded up in the wave of anti-Japanese hysteria that followed the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941. President Roosevelt signed an executive order giving the Army the power, without warrants, indictments, or hearings, to arrest all Japanese-Americans, take them from their homes, transport them to camps far into the interior, and keep them there under prison conditions.
When I was growing up, I was very, very American and very provincial. We were just kids rooting for our high school. Everything changed for me on the day Pearl Harbor was bombed. On that very day, December 7th, the FBI came and they took my father. We found out that he was taken to the federal prison at Terminal Island, we were moved to a detention center in April 1942. I was so red, white, and blue, I couldn't believe this was happening to us. America would never do a thing like this to us. This is the greatest country in the world. So I thought, this is only going to be for a short while, maybe a few weeks or something, and they'll let us go back. I didn't feel the anger that much, because I thought maybe this was the way we could show our love for our country, and we shouldn't make too much fuss or noise. We should abide by what they asked of us. I'm a totally different person now. The more I think about it, the more I realize how little you learn about American history. It's just what they want you to know. We always called the camps relocation centers while we were there. Now we feel it's apropos to call them concentration camps. It's not the same as the concentration camps of Europe. Those were death camps. Here, people were placed in a concentrated area and disempowered and disenfranchised. Historically, Americans have always been putting people behind walls. First, there were the American Indians who were put on reservations, Africans in slavery, Chicanos doing migratory work and the kinds of camps they were put in, and the Chinese when they worked on the railroad camps where they were isolated, dispossessed people. And I feel those are the things we should fight against so they won't happen again.
From the end of World War II through the mid-1950s, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, or HUAC, purportedly investigated evidence of communist activity in the entertainment industry. This was a part of a general attack on civil liberties during the Cold War. One of the artists singled out for attack was the great singer and actor Paul Robeson, a fierce opponent of racism and U.S. foreign policy. Here is part of a statement Robeson intended to present before HUAC, but was not allowed to read.
It is a sad and bitter commentary on the state of civil liberties in America that the very forces of reaction who have denied me access to the lecture podium, the concert hall, the opera house, and the dramatic stage now hail me before a committee of inquisition in order to hear what I have to say. It would be more fitting for me to question them, for it is they who should be called to account for their conduct, not I. Why do they not investigate the truly un-American activities of those to whom the Constitution is a scrap of paper when invoked by the Negro people, and to whom defiance of the Constitution is a racial duty? And why is Secretary of State Dulles afraid to let me have a passport, to let me travel abroad to sing, to act, to speak my mind? State Department lawyers have asserted in court that I have been denied a passport because of what they call my recognized
status as a spokesman for large sections of Negro Americans.
And because I have been,
for years, extremely active in behalf of independence of colonial peoples in Africa.
I am proud that those statements can be made about me. It is my firm intention to continue to speak out against injustices of toward the Negro people. My fight for a passport is a struggle for freedom. Freedom to travel. Freedom to earn a livelihood. Freedom to speak. Freedom to express myself artistically and culturally. By continuing the struggle at home and abroad for peace and friendship with all the world's people. For an end to colonialism. For full citizenship for Negro Americans. For a world in which art and culture may abound, I intend to continue to win friends for the best in American life.
At the 1964 Democratic Party National Convention, delegates from the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party demanded that the all-white delegation from Mississippi, where the population was 40% black, be replaced by a more representative delegation. Sharecropper Fannie Lou Hamer testified to the Credentials Committee on national television. Her eloquence so worried President Johnson that he issued a White House announcement that interrupted the TV coverage. The party, the Democratic Party, refused to seat the black delegates. Here's part of her testimony.
It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register, to try to become first-class citizens. The plantation owner came and said, "Fannie Lou, if you don't go down and withdraw your registration, you will have to leave here because we are not ready for that in Mississippi." And I told him, "I didn't try to register for you. I tried to register for myself." I had to leave that same night. And in June the 9th, 1963, I was returning back from Mississippi from a voter registration workshop. 10 of us was traveling in a bus. When we got to Winona, Mississippi, the 4 people who had gone to use the washroom was ordered out by a state highway patrolman and a chief of police. I stepped off the bus to see what was happening, and somebody screamed, "Get that one there!" A man told me I was under arrest and kicked me. After, I was placed in a cell. I began to hear the sounds of kicks and horrible screams. And I could hear somebody say, "Can you say yes, sir, nigger? Can you say yes, sir?" She would say, "Yes, I can say yes, sir. So say it." She says, "I don't know you well enough." They beat her. I don't know how long, and after a while she began to pray and ask God to have mercy on those people. And it wasn't too long before 3 white men came to my cell. A state highway patrolman said, "We're gonna make you wish you was dead." I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had 2 Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack, and I was beat by that Negro until he was exhausted. All of this on account of us wanting to register, wanting to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hook because our lives be threatened daily? Because we want to live as decent human beings in America.
Westover, the country's largest air reserve base, covers more than 2,500 acres in Chicopee and Ludlow. During the Vietnam War, the first Gulf War, and now again, it has been a focus of anti-war demonstrations. After the 1974 protests at Westover, Margaret Holt, a decades-long peace and justice campaigner, Gray Panther, and prolific letter writer, wrote this to the Springfield Daily News.
"I speak as a woman, 60 years old, who has been arrested twice at Westover. I can't, of course, speak for all those who protest in this way, but I'm sure most of us do what we do out of a desperate need, a profound necessity we feel to stop the war machine, which we see each day destroying more of our country's freedom and security and any honor it has left, even as it literally destroys Indochina. Imaginative efforts are being made to compensate Chicopee for the expense involved in the arrests. Realistically, though, a government which has spent over $100 billion on destruction should be able to afford the relatively tiny sum incurred by those who would stop this colossal waste. Our country desperately needs a whole new definition, a fresh new conception of what honor and freedom and security mean in an age when the weapons we've dreamed up can easily create a moonscape of the earth and wipe out whole populations. I think that most Americans still do not realize the extent to which this is happening in large areas of Indochina right now.
Francis Crowe of Northampton has been a peace activist since the 1950s. She has campaigned in support of the civil rights movement for an end to nuclear testing and in opposition to the wars in Vietnam and in the Middle East. She's been arrested some 36 times, most recently this last month in Washington, D.C., a protest against the war in Iraq. In October 3rd, 1983, Frances was arrested with seven other women, including five nuns, after they broke into the Electric Boat Shipyard in Rhode Island and stenciled the words, "Thou shalt not kill," on the hulls of Trident submarines. She was charged with malicious mischief and sentenced to 6 months in jail. Here is what she told the court at her sentencing in January 1984.
Never before in the history of life on this planet have humans faced an awesome future. I speak of the possible end of life on this planet. Each of us is called to respond to this possibility on our deepest level. Each of us is responsible today and every day for the crime of preparation for nuclear war. I have worked for many years to educate myself and my community about the futility of war. I have vigiled, marched, prayed, written letters to the editor, held meetings, shown films. I've worked through all possible legal channels to prod Congress. I have turned part of my home into a peace center. Trident II is equal in destructive power to 2,040 Hiroshimas. It is the most destructive weapon ever made. What kind of mentality prepares for this kind of destruction? Are there even enough cities on this planet for this horrendous simultaneous destruction? This terrible arms buildup, protected by law of the land. Nevertheless, there are times when the law of the land must be challenged in the name of a higher principle, the law of humanity.
Ronald Reagan's administration began an attack on aid to single mothers, on food stamps, on health care for the poor. The attack culminated during the Clinton administration with the ending of federal guarantees to women with dependent children. In the early Reagan years, a mother wrote to a local newspaper responding to the claim that government was not needed, that private enterprise, the so-called free market, would take care of poverty.
I am on aid to families with dependent children, and both my children are in school. I've graduated from college with distinction, 128th in a class of over 1,000, with a BA in English and sociology. I have experience in library work, child care, social work, and counseling. The employment office has nothing for me. I go every week to the library to scour the newspaper help wanted ads. I have kept a copy of every cover letter that I have sent out with my resume. The stack is inches thick. I work part-time in a library for $3.50 an hour. Welfare reduces my allotment to compensate. I have employment offices that can't employ, governments that can't govern, and an economic system that can't produce jobs for people ready to work. Last week, I sold my bed to pay for the insurance on my car, which, in the absence of mass transportation, I need in order to go job hunting. I sleep on a piece of rubber foam somebody gave me. So this is the great American dream my parents came to this country for. Work hard. Get a good education, follow the rules, and you will be rich. I don't want to be rich. I just want to be able to feed my children and live with some semblance of dignity.
In 1991, nearly 200 students walked out of a Holyoke High School and marched to City Hall to protest voters' rejection of a measure that would have overturned devastating school budget cuts. Soon after, photographer Michael Jacobson Hardy, Holyoke teacher Gloria Cabager Arce, and Hampshire College professor Myrna Margulies Breitbart began the creation of Facing Education, an exhibition and book of portraits of Holyoke school children and their words. The exhibition toured the state. Here are some of the children's words.
Elisa, a sixth grader, said,
"If I could change one thing to make my community a better place for young people, I would change all the racism. We need to think about who we're hurting and when we say things like spick or nigger or faggot to somebody. When children see this racism, it takes an effect on them. They become racist and they will never be the same again. Is this what it's come to? Children becoming racist? But we can still save the kids and people that haven't been affected. It's not too late. Help us fight the war against racism." David, a sixth grader, said,
"If I could change anything about my community to make it better, a better place, I would take out a bar and put in a local boys and girls club for the children." Johanna, a middle schooler, said,
"One of the most beautiful things about Puerto Ricans is that we do not reject other cultures." Chris, in middle school, said,
"What I don't like about my school is the lack of materials. I also don't like the buildings we have. The pipes are broken. The heaters don't work, and I hate the sound installation. Even with all of these problems, the teachers are always working to make the school great." Leah, a middle schooler, said,
"Growing up in Holyoke, I haven't seen a lot of hate. I have seen a lot of hate. I have seen a lot of people discriminate against black people and Puerto Rican people. I don't think it's fair. And if I could pick one thing that will change in my community to make it better for young people, I would end all racism and all the hate. So then the black children, the Puerto Rican children, and the white children can grow up together and be friends. Maybe I can't change it, but if we all work together, maybe we can."
Trudy Lamb Richmond's Scaticoke tribal ancestors were among the first to greet English colonists in what is now Connecticut, before the United States even existed. Despite their persistence in their traditional homelands after hundreds of years of living as colonized peoples, the Scaticoke Nation was recently denied federal recognition by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Trudy Lamb Richmond, in her role as a tribal elder and as director of education for the Meshantucket Pequot Museum, has long served as an advocate for Native Americans in New England.
"When we were young, it was our grandmothers who gathered us around to tell us of many things, of how the world began where we came from, why we must respect all living things, of the wonders of the universe. She always told us of the old ways. And when we were told these things, these truths, we searched her face of many wrinkles and believed she must have been there way back when, in the beginning. So vivid were her words and the picture she created in our mind's eye. It was only when we were much older that we realized this was the way of the elders. Their words were the traditions being passed down from grandmothers and grandfathers. The hypnotic quality of grandmother's carefully selected words healed us, cured us, strengthened and enriched our lives, which we were committed to pass on. Native people's histories have always been told by others, rather dispassionately at times and not always with accuracy. Something is missing when we cannot or do not know our true past. Something is terribly wrong when our past is not accurately recounted. Whose history is told is every bit as important as how history is told.
Margaret H. Marshall is Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Appointed in 1996, Marshall is the second woman ever to serve on a Supreme Judicial Court in its more than 300-year history. She is the first woman to serve as Chief Justice. She wrote the majority opinion in the groundbreaking 2003 civil rights case Goodridge versus Department of Public Health.
Marriage is a vital social institution. The exclusive commitment of two individuals to each other nurtures love and mutual support. It brings stability to our society. For those who choose to marry and for their children, marriage provides an abundance of legal, financial, and social benefits. In return, it imposes weighty legal, financial, and social obligations. The question before us is whether, consistent with the Massachusetts Constitution, the Commonwealth may deny the protections, benefits, and obligations conferred by civil marriage to two individuals of the same sex who wish to marry. We conclude that it may not. The Massachusetts Constitution affirms the dignity and equality of all individuals. It forbids the creation of second-class citizens.
In August of this year, Joyce Lucy of Belchertown received an email from the protesters at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. They were gathering letters from mothers who have lost children to the Iraq War to present those letters to Laura Bush. This is what she wrote.
Dear Mrs. Bush, I am writing to you from my heart as a mom. You have two beautiful 23-year-old daughters. Try to imagine the unthinkable happening. You lose one of them forever. Let me bring you into my world for one moment. I, too, once had a beautiful 23-year-old child. He was a charming and intelligent young man with an engaging smile. He loved his family, and we loved him. This young man was born Jeffrey Michael Lucy on March 18, 1981. Was born. I still find myself unable to breathe for a moment when I talk about Jeff in the past tense. My son will never have a wife or a family of his own. We will never know what he might have aspired to, what he might have offered this world. He was cheated out of the simple joys of life, and we need to know why. Jeffrey joined the Marine Reserves while a freshman in college. We are not a military family, and I was terrified for my son's safety from the moment he signed. The recruiters do a good job at selling the service, but fail to tell them the whole picture. Jeffrey found out the hard way with his life. 1,800 plus and counting. Jeffrey and how many others are not counted in this number? After he returned from Iraq, Jeff struggled for several months from post-traumatic stress disorder. We watched helplessly as he began to experience daily vomiting, nightmares, night sweats, social anxiety, and an inability to focus. Our son suffered in his world of pain and darkness while we tried in vain to get him help. This once happy, strong young man took his own life on June 22, 2004. How do you think your husband would feel if he went down cellar and found Barbara or Jenna hanging from a garden hose? Would your husband and his advisors be so insistent on staying the course if their sons and daughters were next in line to leave for Iraq? It is every citizen's duty to question an action that involves the safety of our young men and women. Please encourage your husband to listen to those who have traveled so far to ask their questions. Help us understand what our children died for. The words of a song my son listened to on the last weeks of his life sum up where Jeff was in May of June 2003. Whatever happened to the young man's heart, swallowed by pain as he slowly fell apart.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Especially Chris Roman. These wonderful people have given of themselves tonight. And they've given themselves in the cause of social and economic justice, and we suggest that all of us find ways to give it back. How can we give it back? This is a fundraiser for Western Massachusetts Jobs with Justice. Yeah. So we have two suggestions. One is money, and the other is action, because J with J is about action. As you leave tonight, please make a donation to Western Massachusetts Jobs with Justice. Volunteers in each aisle have bags for this. Donations are to the Jobs with Justice Fund of the Warren J. Plout Charitable Trust and are tax deductible. Please fill out this yellow form. You can fold your donation in it if you'd like it to be acknowledged. Even if you don't make a gift at this time, please fill out the form. Let's stay in touch. Speaking of gifts, I'd like to bring up Ron Patnode. Ron is the president of the United Auto Workers, Local 2322. He's a member of the Western Massachusetts J with J Executive Committee. Local 2322 is 3,500 strong in Western Massachusetts, and a fierce opponent of wealthy so-called nonprofit healthcare empires that stand in the way of better wages and working conditions for their workers and cost-saving reforms for all of us. Ron.
Good evening, Howard. Brothers and sisters. Would you brothers in, if you'd come up, please. We'd like to thank you on behalf of Western Mass Jobs with Justice. We'd like to thank you for being so generous with your time and helping us. Thank you for trying to tell the truth and provide an alternative to the grossly slanted versions of history we've been fed much of our lives. And I would just add that Dr. King said that, make no mistake, we criticize our country because we love it. And thank you, and I've got a little box over here. Somebody said you enjoy salad. I had this grand idea that I would make like a plaque or something, and they said, make them a salad bowl. We assume he has a lot of friends, and you'll be sharing some salad with someone. And these are my partner, David, and I. We have a small business called The Pottery, and he is my partner. He's my life partner. And Mitt Romney can kiss my gay ass.
As John said, we have two suggestions. The first one was money, in case you didn't catch that. The second one is action. And we'd like to urge you to join the fastest-growing grassroots movement in recent memory, which is the movement to stop Walmartization. Walmart, as you may be aware, is the viciously anti-union, low-wage business model that discriminates against its female and non-white labor, passes its workers' health care costs on to the taxpayers, squeezes its sweatshop suppliers here and abroad, and dictates its ultra-right-wing version of morality in the goods and pharmaceuticals that it refuses to carry. Do we want more of this kind of employer in our valley?
No!
Do we want a Walmart supercenter on Route 9 in Hadley?
No!
You can take action. You can join Hadley residents who are confronting the planning board tonight and at future hearings. On Saturday, November 5th, you can join StopSprawlMart.org on the Amherst Town Commons at 11 a.m. Then November 13th through 20th, you can participate in a week of higher expectations, including premiere showings of Robert Greenwald's new documentary, Walmart, The High Cost of Low Prices. How can you keep up with all this action, John? Fill out the form here tonight, or go to Western Mass Walmart Voices at wmass.walmartvoices.com. Solidarity forever!